The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by MECU, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome this afternoon. We're about to go to traffic to see what's happening on the roads, and when we come back from that traffic report, we're going to have discussion, debate on the Red Line in Baltimore's future. How should it be built? Where should it go? Above ground, underground? What's the state of Baltimore and Maryland transit? You can join us here for that right after this break for the traffic. Support for WEAA traffic is provided by Quaker State, offering Quaker State oil. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. Speaking of commuting and being stuck in traffic, we're talking about things that people hope will leave traffic in our city and around. And the Red Line has been much touted as a new rail line to connect the east and west side. The question is, will connect to the rest of transportation? There is no secret that that Baltimore and Maryland in general, Baltimore specifically, this transit network leaves a great deal to be desired. It has far and away from what they have in Portland or what they have in Denver or our neighbor to the south, Washington, D.C., that already has hundreds of miles of rail that gets people from one place to the other. And we have our 15.5-mile metro subway. Some people say it's a subway to nowhere, or as I actually jokingly like to call it, it was a subway between one Rouse Mall and the other. But it is there, and the buses never seem to meet on time. So transportation has always been an issue here, and I think in all fairness and honesty that Governor Martin O'Malley's administration and Mayor Sheila Dixon's administration are trying to wrestle with this, trying to get the Red Line up and off the ground to begin that process, but it's a great deal more than that. And as you saw by the Sun paper recently, there's a lot of controversy around the Red Line and where it should go. It's a great deal more expensive to put subway, which means underground, than it is to put rail on the ground. And for those of you who are old enough who grew up in Baltimore when we still had trolleys, you knew that above ground you could get from anywhere in the city to anywhere else in the city and even to Woodlawn and Glen Burnie by trolley, which most people took, and I remember taking as well as a little kid. But, of course, then we had General Motors who decided to jump in and destroy all of our mass transit so we could get in their cars and buy their automobiles and get the tire industry moving. But at any rate, you can – two communities at either end of the proposed Red Line – in the west side, around the Edmondson area, have there are issues with what's happening on the Red Line, as does the Kent community in the southeast Baltimore. We're going to talk. We have representatives from both those areas of the city here today and the city. Joining us shortly will be people from the CPHA as well. In studio, we have Jamie Kendrick, who's deputy director of the Baltimore City Department of Transportation, who was here last for our town meeting on the stimulus package bill. Good to see you again, Jamie. Welcome.
Thanks for having us, Mark.
Always good to have you here. Warren Smith is president of the Greater West Hills Community Association and a member of the Citizens Advisory Council for the Red Line. And Warren, good to see you, man. Good to have you on the show. Welcome.
Thank you, Mark.
Daryl Jerkowitz is with us, and Daryl Jerkowitz is president of the Canton Community Association. And Daryl, welcome. Good to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
And I did get your last name right, did I, right?
Yes, you did.
Good. All right. And Dan Pontius will be here shortly. He's on his way from another meeting. He is executive director of the Citizens Planning and Housing Association and has involved for years at TPHA and other places in transportation issues in this city. The number here is 410-319-8888. Some of you have already called in, and we can write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. And some of you already know that address because emails are already here, which we'll get to shortly. So let's talk about this. I mean, Baltimore, would anybody in this room disagree with the fact the Baltimore's transportation system is lacking?
Mark, I think it's a point that has been well said over the years.
Jamie Kendrick from the
yes.
city.
And, you know, we've been criticized for years for the lack of a transit system, for the lack of connectivity in a transit system. And so this is really the opportunity, right? I think there are legitimate questions and concerns about the wheres and the hows. But the need for the Red Line, I don't think, is disputed probably by anybody in this room, even those who have legitimate concerns about where it ought to be. But this really is an opportunity for the Baltimore region, not just the city, the region, to take the next step in creating a system of rail lines. We have the 2002 Baltimore Region Rail System Plan, which brought us to this point, that recommended the red line between Social Security Area and Johns Hopkins Bayview as the first priority segment in building out that 106-mile system.
So going from Woodlawn all the way over to Greektown.
Correct, yeah, about a 14.5-mile corridor.
Connecting neighborhoods in Baltimore, they're always divided and never really connected, especially between black and white and across many kind of class lines as well. This is kind of bringing a city together as nothing else has, I think, in some ways.
I think that's a great point that we'll probably explore a little bit more as we go on.
Yep. So now let's talk about some of the objections to this. I mean, one of the things you see from the red line is it's going through highly populated areas. Every piece of analysis that I've read about the rail line says that there are at least 26, if not more, organizations that hire 1,000 people or more on that line. There could be a lot of traffic on that line. People are getting to and from work. A lot of schools are on that line, and now that Andres Alonso is CEO of our public school system, and every school in the city will be a charter school, so to speak, and has to take every child no matter where they live, there could be a lot of kids on these transit lines going from one end of the city to the other. So, and they have to go somewhere, but they're going through your neighborhoods. This is where they're going. So let's talk about the issues you see, because I think Jamie just said about both you, Warren Smith and Darryl Jerkowitz, that neither one of you nor most people in your communities are opposed to the red line or opposed to putting it in. Am I right about that?
We're not opposed to better and Darryl more Jerkowitz. Efficient mass transit. We are opposed to alternative 4C as it has been presented to us as a surface line down Boston Street.
And how about, Warren, how about, let me get that mic a little closer up to your face.
The state constantly says if we accept 4C that they will do alternatives, which I have difficulty with because at this level it's already in the federal government's hands, and amendments and addendums, I'm not sure or have we been assured that it can be added.
Well, we should define some things for all of our listeners here, because this is important. Because people have heard this nomenclature before. Let's talk about what we're talking about here. What is alternative 4C? What does it mean?
I'll try and give a run through, and Darryl and Warren can jump in and tell me if they see it differently.
Okay.
Starting on the west, it would be at the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services on the far end of Security Boulevard, at grade, meaning running along the street. Typically in the median, maybe on one side or the other.
That's in Baltimore County.
That's in Baltimore County, correct.
Right.
To the Social Security complex itself on Security Boulevard, continuing in Security Boulevard or in the existing I-70 spur out in western Baltimore County to the city line at Cooks Lane, probably more likely on the I-70 itself there. And then coming underneath Cooks Lane from that point, so in a tunnel under Cooks Lane up to Route 40. And then at Route 40, somewhere around Winans Way or the Edmondson Village Shopping Center, coming out of the tunnel and being on the surface of Edmondson Avenue, much like, as you pointed out, the streetcar used to be, and being in the median of Edmondson Avenue all the way in through and across the Gwynns Falls and Hilton Street, with stations along the way about every mile or so. Excuse me. And then from there, continuing east on Franklin and Mulberry to the West Baltimore MARC station, so creating a great connection there to people who want to get to D.C. on the MARC train. Coming in the old Highway to Nowhere, which my friend Zelda Robinson in West Baltimore now calls the Highway to Somewhere as a part of this project. Then from the Highway to Nowhere goes along Martin Luther King and into a tunnel at Martin Luther King underneath Lombard Street with two or three stations downtown, down to Harbor East along Alisana or Fleet Street, more likely Fleet Street at this point, again staying in a tunnel all this way. And then coming out of the tunnel somewhere around the intersection of Fleet and Boston, or Alisana and Boston, and then being on the surface of Boston Street all the way down to Haven Street, Canton Crossing area, and then following the old freight line up Haven Street corridor to Greektown at Eastern Avenue, and then on to Johns Hopkins Bayview campus, where it would end at a MARC station on the east side. So connecting to two major highways to get people off of the road before they come into the smaller interior streets in the city.
Talking about 95 and 70.
Yes, on the east side it's 95, 895, and the Amtrak Northeast Corridor, where we could have a MARC station. So we could really have a huge opportunity on the east side to get people out of their cars before they ever come into Boston Street.
And 70 would then have a gigantic parking lot somewhere?
That's correct. So all those folks who today, myself included, Warren, drive in Cook's Lane to get to Route 70 or vice versa, would now have a place to get off and not drive through the neighborhood.
So let's go to your two neighborhoods. I mean, Warren Smith from the west side of town and Darrell Jerkowitz from Canton in the lower east side of town, southeast side of town. What's the objection to that?
Okay.
Warren Smith, you go ahead first.
First of all, the plan was designed in the early 40s. It was a Baltimore Transit engineer plan with no name on it. For the last 70 years, they've been blossoming it and blooming it to what is called the Red Line today. There's been no justification of a real honest study of the residents, the changes since the 40s to today's society. I-70 is not where the majority of the population come from. They basically come from Howard County, Frederick, and Carroll. The majority of those people come from 29 to 70 to avoid 40. And they're not putting the transit system where the need is. They're putting the transit system to this old, antiquated
plan. Well,
where's
the need? Why is it?
The need for the transit system should be a system to service Howard County, where the bedroom community can park their cars in their community and commute to Baltimore. Historically, if a person drives more than 15 minutes, they are not getting out of their car.
The question. So let me ask this question. I'm going to ask Darrell similar questions when he kind of raises issues about Ken. So I'm trying to put all this on the table. But what I understand is, I understand what you're saying, and I think that there. I mean, for a long time, for 16 years, I've been advocating they should stop building highways between Columbia and Baltimore and put a rapid rail that goes through Howard County to Baltimore and connects Baltimore. But meanwhile, let's say for argument's sake that's a strong argument that you're making. The Red Line itself, though, goes from 70 through the West Side neighborhoods, Edmondson, and down through the highway to nowhere that destroyed that neighborhood when it was built, and now will connect to the Mark and go through downtown into the East Side, over to Bayview and all those jobs away. So I still understand what the objection is to that. That's what I haven't gotten to.
The objection is, we don't want it on surface in West Baltimore.
Oh, okay. Now we're getting some. It's where you don't like where it's placed.
The design, as I stated earlier, they wanted to amend it with the federal level to go underground. It isn't going to cost that much more. It grew from 10.2 miles to 14 miles. That was an expense. Underground from I-70 to at least Calverton Road is not the astronomical figure that the state has come up with. In fact, 1.2 miles in East Baltimore costs $2.2 million. 1.7 miles in West Baltimore, a half mile longer, costs $525 million. Why in the West Baltimore community are they increasing the numbers 2.5 times the actual costs?
Just if I can, I mean, let me clarify the numbers that I think Warren was saying. On the east side, to extend, as I think Darrell would like to see happen, the tunnel from Boston and Alisana out to, say, Haven Street, Canton Crossing area, about $202 million. On the west side, to connect in tunnel from roughly Cook's Lane to Calverton Road, is about $525 million, as Warren said. But there's very good reasons why the cost difference, even though the mileage is... It's not exactly the same. It's in the same neighborhood. On the west side, you have the Gwynns Falls Valley that you've got to get under or over somehow. That you have two additional stations in the area. Stations are about $40 million, $40 to $60 million each. You also have a very different construction type on the west side because of the nature of the rock that would require a different type of tunneling. So the cost, and then frankly, it is a longer segment. It's about 1.75 miles to get from Cook's Lane to Calverton Road versus the Boston Street segment, which is about 0.7 miles or so.
Let me just jump in. I mean, we've heard the beginning of Warren Smith's objections that represent more than Warren Smith, that represent a lot of people in your communities that you represent in your association. Let me hear from Canton, and I'll just try to put these together and see where we are with all this.
From day one, we've never been in favor of surface rail line. Wherever it comes through Canton, it should be underground, whether Boston Street, Fleet Street, or Eastern Avenue. rail lines don't get along with vehicular traffic and truck traffic, which we have quite a bit in Southeast. Further down the road, we're trying to figure out how to avoid rail lines, and here we are wanting to put more rail lines down.
Well, what do you mean further down the road we're trying to avoid rail lines?
There's railroad crossings on Boston Street between Conklin and Ponca Street.
Yep.
And there's 27 train crossings every day. Traffic gets backed up. And the rail line down Boston Street would curve off of Boston Street right between Conklin and Haven Street. And it's two major intersections.
So, Jamie, so the question becomes, before we kind of look at it another way, and it sounds almost like a no pun intended, it's a pedestrian argument, but it's not, because you're talking about communities who think there should not be rail lines running down the street in front of their homes and other places, and that it all should be underground. So what's the argument about why it should not be underground, and is it cost, is it something else?
I think, first and foremost, it is cost. I mean, we're talking probably a $600 million or so difference to add both the segments underground that Warren and Daryl are talking about.
A piece but or together?
Together. And I don't think, because of the legacy of the system in the east side, west side, and frankly the federal laws around environmental justice, that we would ever be able to legally get away with doing Boston Street but not Edmondson Avenue, or Edmondson Avenue but not Boston Street. So
you're
I think there's a real equity argument to be made there about doing one versus the other.
And let's put what you're saying on the table here. What we're saying is, because the west side of town is predominantly African American and has always gotten
The short end of the stick.
I was trying to not get it thrown off the air. The short end of the stick when it comes to environmental hazards, though I would say white working class communities in South Baltimore and East Side have also suffered from the same kind of environmental degradation in the neighborhood. So working class communities are always getting screwed. So that's, having said that, finish.
No, I think that's exactly where we're going here, is that the federal rules around equity and environmental justice just wouldn't let us do one without the other, at which point you've pushed the project so far beyond the federal cost effectiveness requirements. So, and frankly, even beyond that, our ability to pay for any project, that it just exceeds any reasonable ability to construct the project.
This question I've been wanting to ask ever since I saw the newspaper, and I'll let you gentlemen just jump in anytime. You don't have to be too polite. But we kind of just jump in here. But I mean, cost effectiveness. What does that mean? I mean, if we are talking about trying to create a transportation system in the United States of America, and we're talking about our hometown of Baltimore right now, that is a 21st century transportation system that gets people from one place to the other, get people out of their cars and onto rail or onto their bicycles or some other thing, then how are you judging cost effectiveness? How is the government defining cost effectiveness?
Well, unfortunately, we are not, which is, I think, the central problem here, which is the federal government, the Federal Transit Administration, has a cost effectiveness requirement for certain projects, and there's very complicated ratios about user benefits and number of riders and length of system and cost and operating capital cost, operating cost. Let's set that aside for a second, right? I think that whether or not we could get to a cost effectiveness rating that meets the federal requirements is one issue. Even if we were able to get there, right, we would have to then come up with the additional local funds, non-federal funds, to build the project. So let's say at a $1.3 billion, $1.4 billion, we meet the test. Let's say at $1.7 billion, $1.8 billion, $1.9 billion, we meet the cost effectiveness test. Somebody's got to come up with that $600 million difference, right, between those two. And I'm not.
I just want to understand for our listeners too. Which the numbers you throw out is including their arguments about going underground.
That's
is that correct?
So let's say we take it to $2 billion, $1.9 billion, $2 billion. You know, for
what's $100 million?
What's $100 million, my friends? Right. Somebody's got to come up with the next $600 or $700 million to pay for it. It's not going to be the federal government. So I think the question we have to answer ourselves is, do we want to pay a higher gas tax? I personally don't have an issue with that, but you know, it's a question that legislators are going to have to answer.
And you're saying you're saying that for yourself, not for your government.
That's right.
Right.
You know, because I think transit's worth every penny of it. So the question of where do you come up with that next $600 or $700 million is a very real one, because it's not going to be the federal government.
So let me ask you gentlemen this question. Let's say for argument's sake that, again, that your argument's that it's better to put rail underground than above ground.
Yes.
Clearly,
yes.
Underground costs more money than above ground. There's no question about it.
Yes.
So where do you propose that we, the people, get the money to pay for this?
I would like to propose that first...
Warren Smith.
We go back to the drawing table. The same company that did the Boston Big Dig is here in Maryland doing projects. Their quality, in, first, as a state, we should ask for the best project we can get at the most economic cost that we can get. They have no competition. They inflate the numbers however they so see fit.
How do you know? What do you mean they inflate the numbers how they so see fit?
Well, here's an example of the inflated numbers right here between East Baltimore and West Baltimore. The justification by one person's standard says West Baltimore is bedrock. Well, East Baltimore is soft soil that's at water level.
And is in a flood zone.
So,
and requires two very different construction methodologies and has two very different costs. I mean, the facts are the facts when it comes to cost, right?
That's the city's position.
Yes.
This belongs to the citizens of Maryland, residents of this affected impact community, and you all won't even include us in the negotiations. You all have a blue ribbon panel to make the suggestions on what we, the affected communities, want.
Hang on, Warren, you're on the Red Line Citizens Advisory Committee. The Citizens Advisory Committee on which you sit voted to support Alternative 4C. And I think that's a fact worth pointing out. The legislature created a Citizens Advisory Committee.
How many citizens are on the committee?
There are 11 or 13, I can't remember which, off the top of my head.
No, I mean but citizens from the community.
The legislature appointed that committee. You all asked the legislature to appoint that committee. The legislature did so. It has three government representatives, two from Baltimore City government, one from Baltimore County government. The rest are citizen members.
That's not true.
All right, well, let me just get...
They voted to support Alternative 4C.
They took a vote before they had the public input.
We've had 4 years of public input on the project.
Then why aren't you listening to what the rest citizens want?
Let me try to get some clarity here about what is being said. I want to try to figure out. Now, folks, we are going to open the phones. You have 410-319-8888 to have your input. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. I see Ben has been holding on for a long time. We're going to come to your call in just a bit. I just want to get some of these facts on the table here and ideas from both sides. 410-319-8888 as we debate the future of the Red Line. So the question is, I mean, I still want to come back to the original question, then I'm going to jump into what you two were criticizing the government for, the government of both state and city. It is going to cost more money, whether it's $400 million or $600 million or $800 million, whatever that cost is going to be, it costs more money to tunnel underground than to put rail on top of the ground. That's just reality. So if it costs that much more money and the feds are not going to pay for it, what I want to ask the two of you representing your communities and your neighbors and what they're saying, where does the money come from? How do we pay for it?
Go back to the original plan, which is 10.2 miles. Forget the special interests such as Johns Hopkins.
But people work there. That's why it's there.
See, Bayview and Johns Hopkins has its own shuttle. Johns Hopkins already has from Owings Mills to Johns Hopkins line. Now they're about to get a second service. Johns Hopkins has its own transportation system. They have its own fleet of buses. And Baltimore was based on neighborhood transportation service, not employment transportation service, because after Friday, the people are left in the neighborhoods. We cannot go downtown if by the future plan, and you just stated yourself, employment.
Okay. Daryl?
I believe that the money can be found in the federal government, but also in the state government. I personally don't have a problem with a higher gas tax, and I drive quite a bit. Unfortunately, I can't use public transportation. I'm a field service technician. But I don't think all the alternatives have been looked at properly.
What do you mean by that? What alternatives have not been looked at properly?
As I said before, we prefer it underground.
Mm-hmm.
We feel the best place underground would be under Eastern Avenue, which is the most direct route to Bayview, and that's where most of the riders are now, mass transit riders. And one of the things we asked the MTA to give us numbers on are the numbers now from the number 10 bus riders versus the number 11, which comes down Boston Street. And it's probably 20 or 25 to 1 on Eastern Avenue.
So, no, I mean, that's a strong. So there are strong arguments here that maybe two things. I mean, A, there are strong arguments about the communities are making, it seems to me, about the efficacy of underground and pushing this notion a tad further. But B, there's also a deadline, if I'm right, gentlemen, that has to go to the federal government, to Congress to the Department of Transportation by the summer. By when is it, July?
Mid-July. So, I mean, I think, again, Daryl and Warren make legitimate points. There are very legitimate concerns. I'm sure we're going to hear some more from your callers. I think the question is, do we want to set the whole thing aside and not proceed and not build out the system, or do we want to sit down and find a way to make it work? We've had, I think, some real progress in communities working through many of these issues with us. We've had some real success stories in West Baltimore, in particular around the MARC station there. One of the legacies that we have to deal with in this entire corridor, west and east, is the Highway to Nowhere and the highway that would have been built on the east side. Because we are now talking about the Red Line project and the need to build stations at a Red Line station at the West Baltimore MARC station, the MTA has already committed, and it's going to happen this fall or winter, to tear down the last two sections of the Highway to Nowhere. Those are probably the two most obnoxious sections that sit with 15-foot walls right in front of people's houses.
What's going to happen there?
Well, first thing we'll do is we'll create more parking. The community is demanding more parking in the neighborhood because the MARC parking already overflows into the neighborhoods. So it will also create a cleaner path for the Red Line to get into the highway. So
a short highway between Edmondson Avenue and MLK is going to be gone?
Just the first two sections we're going to take down. That's the two sections that are kind of elevated from the community's perspective. The rest of the community sits kind of on top of the highway, for lack of a better term. So, you know, if you think about the legacy of the Highway to Nowhere, we are actually taking steps now to wipe away that legacy. And even thinking more recently, look, we know we have a long and not particularly great legacy in transit in the region of Howard Street, and that keeps getting used against us. But I guess I would remind people that Howard Street was dead long before the light rail ever came down there.
Right. But I think we all agree that particular design and way of doing things was not a very good design, or it doesn't really work.
I think that's right.
It's ugly.
It was yeah, that's a good word for it. It was the first of three light rail projects in the country, Baltimore, San Diego, and St. Louis, all built the first generation light rail projects at the same time. Governor Schaefer insisted on doing it quick and doing it cheap, and I think we got the result that we got for doing it cheap. And then, frankly, the vehicles, I think even the MTA would tell you, the vehicles that were chosen at the time were the wrong vehicles for the corridor. I will also tell you that the vehicles we're looking at for the Red Line, for Boston Street, Edmondson Avenue, are literally about half the size, physically, of what we're talking about. So I think we've come a long way in our thinking about these kind of projects, and if the communities would come to the table and really work through some of these issues, I think we could get to a good result at the end.
We have to take a short break. We'll come right back from this brief break. And when we do come back, I want to go to Ben, who was quoted in the Sun. I'm seeing from my screen here is on the phone. Ed, who said he's a member of the Red Line Citizens Council, is also on the line here. We have two emails that have come in. We want to read those. We're going to come back to our callers and our guests in the studio with me. You just heard Jamie Kendrick, Deputy Director of the Baltimore City Department of Transportation. Warren Smith is President of the Greater West Hills Community Association and a member of the Citizens Advisory Council on the Red Line. Daryl Jerkowitz is President of the Canton Community Association. 410-319-8888 is the number here. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of services. MeQ was formed in 1936 to help people during the Great Depression. Over 70 years later, they're still there to help people during difficult times. More information, go to MECU.com. We'll be right back. I'm Mark Steiner. We're debating and discussing the Red Line today. I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-4444. 7555. We are in the studio with Jamie Kendrick, Deputy Director of the Baltimore City Department of Transportation, Warren Smith, who is President of the Greater West Hills Community Association and a member of the Citizens Advisory Council for the Red Line, and Daryl Jerkowitz, who is President of the Canton Community Association. We've also just been joined by Dan Pontius, who had another meeting but came here as soon as the meeting was over. He's Executive Director of the Citizens Planning and Housing Association and for years was the head of their transportation group. The double transportation issues have been a guest on this show more times than I can count. welcome to have you all back with us. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. A lot of emails have come in, so let me get to these questions. There was a debate taking place here during the break. I won't get into all the details of the debate, but one of the things that was said back and forth was, this can wait. And the question is, it cannot really wait when we have transportation systems that are, I mean, I'm not saying that this plan the city has is the plan to go with, but I'm just saying, can it really wait? It doesn't have to be dealt with now because we have very serious transportation crisis in this country. We have to get people into rail or we're going to choke to death in America. I mean,
well, let's talk about the Boston Street Corridor for a second because I think it's a great point. Today, there are 3 of 13 intersections in the Boston Street Corridor that are technically in a failing condition, meaning it takes a good while to get through the intersection. In your typical gateway corridor in the city, Harford Road, Frederick Road, Eastern Avenue, you have about 14,000 trips per day, right? Car trips per day. In the Boston Street Corridor alone, between Canton Crossing and Harbor East, President Street area, we're looking at an average of 13,000 peak hour trips. Not trips per day, but peak hour trips, given the projected growth in the corridor over the next 10 years. If people don't feel like they're choking on traffic today, what in the world is it going to be like, you know, 10 years from now?
This is your neighborhood.
Yes, but adding 2 rail lines down Boston Street is going to help matters. I mean, it's going to slow the light rail down, having to stop for traffic signals and trucks and cars.
Let me ask Dan Pontius, and I do want to open the phones right after this, your comment. And I'm probably first go to Ben, and then go right to Ed, and then read some emails.
Let me just jump in.
Have you been listening
to
this conversation in your car as you've been driving up?
A little bit.
Okay.
If the green line were built, he would have taken the green line up here.
That's right.
That's true. We need that as well.
Well, actually, looking at time, I mean, one interesting thing is when you look at the Washington system, we actually had a plan at the same time that the Washington metro area had a transit plan. 1965 was our first transit plan, same time as their 103-mile plan, and they built there. We both started ours at the same time in the mid-70s. We both broke ground, and they built theirs, and we kind of stalled fits and starts on our subway line. Turned out to be much more expensive than we thought it would be. Then we built we were looking for something less expensive, and in the 80s, transit planners came up with the light rail line, and we built that. We kind of swung to the other end of the pendulum and built the cheapest thing that we could possibly build, and then that stalled after that, too. So we are in a position of, you know, when are we going to get going on this stuff? It's easy to, you know, there are plans that come out there and that don't get built. And the question is, when are we going to kind of figure out how do we make these things work within the confines of how we fund transit projects in this country?
Gentlemen, is it okay if I'd like to open the phones here? So right away, 410-319-8888. Ben, you've been waiting for a while. You're on the air.
I just want to make a few brief points. First of all, I live in Canton, but I agree completely with everything that Mr. Smith had to say, because I think the issues for his part of town are the exact same as the ones on our side of town, on the east side. Regarding my good friend Jamie Kendrick, no one disagrees with the need for improved and rapid mass transit in this area. But the need is important. I analogize this to a patient who goes into the hospital because he needs an appendectomy, and instead the doctors amputate his right arm. The need is not being served by the solution that Mr. Kendrick and his colleagues are proposing here. Having a light rail line on Boston Street or Edmondson Avenue at the surface is not mass transit, is not rapid transit. It's slow transit, and it's going to be very unattractive to the people that the MTA wants to attract. Everybody agrees with this, that the way to do this correctly is to do it underground. And if you don't have enough money to do it now, and this is the answer to your question, Mark, if you don't have enough money to do it all now, do as much as you can now with the available funds and finish it when more money becomes available in the future, as it inevitably will. It makes no sense, and this whole issue of cost effectiveness, how could it be cost effective to destroy a neighborhood? Mr. Smith's area on the west side was already destroyed by the good Governor Schaefer with that road to nowhere, and only now Senator Mikulski saved Boston Street and Canton from a similar fate.
And Lincoln Park, when I was living there, we were part of that too, to stop it from going through Lincoln Park.
That's exactly
where
right.
I lived.
And now, and 30 years later, the MTA is proposing to do the very same thing that Senator Mikulski and others fought so hard against, which is using Boston Street, a scenic byway that has all those pretty black-eyed Susans and stuff like that on the road signs, and just destroy it with a scar right down the middle of it. Last comment:
okay.
I have two children who live in the San Francisco Bay Area. They're grown, and I'm out there frequently. My wife and I go out there frequently to see them and to see our grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
They put a light rail system called the Muni right down the center of the Embarcadero, which is the San Francisco equivalent to Boston Street. And it cut off downtown from the waterfront at the ferry building and on the east side of the Embarcadero. And they hate it today, and they're trying now to remove that very system.
Ben, I appreciate you holding on
Thank
for so long.
Thank you very much.
Glad you got it all out. Let me go to another caller here. And then we'll come back to our panel and read these emails. I mean, here's 410-319-8888. Ed, you're on the air, and you identify yourself as a member of the Red Line Citizens Council as well, right?
Yes, I'm also the Rail Committee Chair for the Transit Riders Action Council.
Oh, you're Edward Cohen.
Yes, I am.
Okay, all right, go ahead.
Okay, hi, everyone.
Hi.
Hey, how you doing, Ed?
There are several issues here. One has to do with the cost-effectiveness formula. Right now we're locked into it, but we have an expiring federal transportation bill. If that federal transportation bill expires, there is going to be a new cost effectiveness formula, because the one that exists right now is a flawed formula, and everybody knows what the flaws are. It's rigged in ways that favor western cities and that favor surface over tunnel in ways that have nothing to do with value, and that favor bus over rail in ways that have nothing to do with value. It's supposed to be a formula that evaluates the value per unit, and it doesn't do it. We need to wait so that we don't make the same highway to nowhere mistake that we made in the past, where we say, well, we'll take the money now because it will bring a few construction jobs, and then we wreck our city. That's not a solution. The Red Line Proposal 4C is supposed to take 62 minutes to go from CMS over to Bayview. Currently, the 40 bus does it in 47 minutes. So we're not talking about fast. What we're talking about is something that is very expensive for what it provides. The MTA looked at a heavy rail extension on the east side over to Greektown, and they found that it would only cost $576 million. That means that you've covered the east side if you go down to the Travel Plaza, and you could have bus connections that would get everybody where they need to go, and
okay.
It would keep the traffic off Boston.
All right. The more minutia and detail we get into, the more we're going to get lost, though, in this conversation. But I hear what you're saying. Quick question for you. Earlier in the show, we had a discussion about the Baltimore Red Line Citizens Advisory Council and the vote that took place.
Yes.
And the vote took place for this plan.
Yes.
So, do you have a quick comment on that?
There has been a problem with the Citizens Advisory Council in that there have been a number of people who've stopped coming. And right now, the number of citizens that show up is lower than it's supposed to be. It's not the number of citizens that are in the law, because there are a number of seats that are vacant. There have even been questions in some cases, although I don't think it occurred on the vote, as to whether or not a quorum was present when action was taken.
All right. Ed, thank you so much for your call. And before we go back to the phones here, people from the west side are calling in as well. Let me talk about what needs to happen here. I mean, let me read an email and we can kind of discuss this. Vincent writes in, there's really both essential part here. It's very important to note that residents of Canton do recognize a need for increased and better public transportation. We want it badly and have been continuously open to working with the MTA on an alternative that we can all support. But the planners are ignoring our community comments from day one. They have come to our meetings and listened and have completely ignored us. Most residents do support some form or general idea of east-west public transportation system, but a lot of those supporters aren't informed about the solutions that better fit everyone's needs, including a subway underground option down Boston Street or a route change to Eastern Avenue. Certainly everyone would agree that either of those solutions would make more sense for a majority of potential users. Surface rail down Boston Street makes no sense. We also have someone who wrote in saying, as a resident of Canton, Boston Street goes down to two lanes, and there's a railroad crossing just to the east of the First Mariner Building. There have been discussions for years about this problem. The other variable no one talks about is the Port of Baltimore that's working piers on Clinton Street. This is a street running north-south by the First Mariner Bank. Now the city would like to terminate the Red Line in the same area. Where's all the present traffic? They can't get other tracks when there's a train going to be diverted to when two lanes are taken away for the Red Line on Boston Street, not to mention parking that we moved on Boston Street. More importantly, cars at the terminus of the Red Line near the First Mariner will be using the Red Line. So that's similar to what you were saying earlier, Darrell. And one more, and then we'll get back to the conversation. John writes in, since I live one block from Boston Street, I'm thrilled to hear a rail line would run one block away and my property value would rise, no doubt about it, just to take a quick look at what DC Metro did to property values. But locating the Red Line on Boston Street, one block from the water, seems to make no sense simply because there are relatively few people living on the south side of Boston. Locating a line on Eastern Avenue or Baltimore Street, for example, would attract riders to the north and south on the line, a larger catchment area. I asked this in a few Red Line meetings, but never received an answer. Thanks, says John. All right, let's wrestle with what we just heard here before we go back to the phones.
All right, I would like to comment, unless you have a question.
No, go ahead, Warren.
I would like to comment that in the emails, something very true came out. The questions have been asked. The residents haven't gotten any answers. Ed made a point about the TLU money about to run out. And if it does run out, I would rather see a system built that we're honorable of versus the non-connectivity that we have currently. Knowing the history of Baltimore, you opened this program up, I'm remembering these streetcars. Baltimore had a great modeled transit system, and it would take you everywhere. We've lost our point for the future by focusing on employment and those high-risk employers. Yes, Johns Hopkins is my number one employer in Baltimore City.
Of the state.
Of the state. And then there's Social Security Administration, which is growing. But those residents have to get out of their communities to get to those jobs. And that system running from east to west is not the problem. It's the design. It has to be underground, just like Washington, D.C.
Let's talk about what should happen from here. I mean, we've got there is a critical point, it seems to me, at the mid-July when a report has to be at the DOT in Washington, D.C. So what happens between now and then, between city and community and planning? Where does it go? How does the decision get made about what to do and where the money comes from?
I'm glad that's how we can spend the last 10 minutes, because I do think we need to figure out what the path forward here is. And it's very easy for people, city itself included, to kind of get stuck in its positions because we're under a timeline here. I mean, my hope is, and I know Darrell and Warren well enough to know that they're people of goodwill and good faith and that they want to work through this because they do want to have a red line of some form. And so my hope is that people will come to the table and have the conversation, and maybe there's some adjustments we can make. Maybe we can pull it a little bit farther east on Edmondson Avenue or on Boston Street in a tunnel. Maybe we can't. I don't know. If it's going to be on the surface, what can we do to make it a more palatable option for the communities? And if the answer is nothing, then I'm not sure we have much to discuss. But if the answer is, well, maybe we can make some investments in the neighborhoods, maybe we can do this without a catenary system that has poles and wires, maybe we can do this with the green tracks so that we don't lose our attractive median, then I think we can work some things through. But if the answer is just no, then I'm not sure where we go from there.
Dan Pontius?
Yeah, and I think we need to think about how do we leverage transit as an asset too. I mean, we sponsored some trips. Daryl went on one of them in 2005 and worked with the city on some more trips in 2008, where we saw other cities that had surface transit systems that had really used them to make the most of that asset for the communities.
Where did you go?
Portland was one of the cities, Denver, Los Angeles. We went to Boston in 2005. Boston's a city that never pulled up its streetcars, so it's still got the Green Line that they use as an asset in those communities. But we also learned there's a lot of experience around the country about how to do transit and how not to do transit, because there have been experiences where the construction has disrupted businesses. And so we went to Denver, where there was a real cautionary tale about a kind of a teetering business district that was really hurt by 2 years of uninterrupted construction for a light rail line. But then we went to Portland, where they saw, you know what, we can do it in little sections. So we'll do construction for a few months in this area, then we'll move down, do the next section, then we'll do the next section. And while we're under construction, we'll take buses and bring in people to have lunch at the businesses right there to make sure that they're still getting business during construction. And then at the end of it, the people there loved the fact that they didn't have to go into a tunnel to get to their transit. So there are ways, and I think, I don't know if you folks have talked about the Red Line Community Compact, but that is a place. We worked with the city and a number of communities to put all these best practices in one document, so that there's a document that the MTA has signed, that the city has signed, that a number of communities have signed as well, that we've signed, that lays out how we can use the best lessons from transit construction in other cities and doing land use and doing working with the neighborhoods and building it into neighborhoods all along the line. How do we use those best practices to make this a real asset all along the line?
And if I can, I think, you know, 70 community organizations, civic organizations along the line signed onto this compact, and they said, I think part of what we said here today, which is we want the red line, we've got to figure out a way to make it work, no matter what form it ultimately takes, we're going to sit at the table and work it through.
So, I mean, Daryl Jerkowitz, so you went on this trip to Portland.
To Denver.
Denver, and you saw the surface rail working.
Yes. The main street that it came down was, if I remember right, almost twice the width of Boston Street. And when it didn't come down through the neighborhoods, it was mainly used existing rail. Boston Street, between Alisana and Conklin Street, is five lanes, two parking lanes, two travel lanes, and one center turn lane. You're basically talking about removing 40% of those lanes and approximately 200 parking spaces, which we direly need more of. And I don't understand how the travel lanes would work, you know, one in each direction, one parking lane or a center turn lane. And there's so much legal truck traffic that uses Boston Street and Clinton Street that would just interfere with the light rail on the surface.
Well, if it's true, then, that some of the design, I mean, I drove down there the other day trying to think about this, that some of these designs are just not palatable, then what do we do? I mean, in A, we have to figure out a way to pay for underground construction, which could cost anywhere from $400 to $800 million more than we're talking about right now. Or different routes have to be found, and you have to find them fairly quick because every state in the union is going to be vying for this money. Baltimore's not the only place in getting money. Everybody's trying to get this money.
Well, you know, Mark, this is a marathon, not a sprint, right? We are at a point where we have to go a little faster to finish up this phase of the design, but I think it's important to remember that essentially what we have is a corridor at this point, and the proposal for which streets it would go on. Is the station 100 feet here or 100 feet there? Is it on the north side of Boston, the south side, or the median? That's all, as we move through the design process, things that we've got to work through with the neighborhoods. So where driveways are located, where turn lanes are located, where new signals are located, we have got to figure that out with the neighborhoods at the table. It's not like we've figured out every final engineering detail here. There's a lot we still have to learn. And the only way that we can do this and do this well is to do it with the neighborhoods at the table.
Go ahead, Warren Smith.
Both gentlemen have made the most mention. Dan, I want to thank you for making the comment about the compact, the Red Line Community Compact. That was a good base, but there's 66 communities involved. not the businesses, not the social groups, but the affected communities. We want a community benefit agreement. We want to design our neighborhood without city's input. Those communities are entitled to economic development. We want, if you want a viable city, those communities are entitled to economic development that those leaders have set out and developed, designed, and that community put forth. We in West Baltimore, we have from Hilton Street to Social Security, homeowners who would like to see the red line, yes, but not the way it's been imposed upon our lives. We have a voice, and until we all sit down and discuss what would get this system through my block, we're not going anywhere. I believe it's the same in East Baltimore. How do we get it through my block?
There are two things. Very quickly, I'm going to go right to the phones here because there are a number of people from these different neighborhoods calling in. I want to get their thoughts. I'm going to ask you all to come back again for round 2, 3, 4 over the next month and a half because this is critical to the future of this community, our community, where we're going. And these are very important questions we've raised. Let me go to Joyce in West Baltimore. Joyce, we only have a few minutes, so welcome. Joyce, you there?
Yes, I'm here.
We only have a couple of minutes, so.
Hi, I'm the past one of the past co-chairs of the Citizen Advisory Committee, mm-hmm. and I left that committee because for me, for Baltimore to become a city that can compete with D.C. and really Philly, we need transportation. We need improved transportation. We need more communities to come to the table, such as Mr. Smith, to say, okay, this is what we can compromise on. They want it all their way. In my opinion, from the conversations I've had.
Who wants it all their way?
A lot of the communities, we want this. We have to work in a compromisable way. We also need to look for our future residents in Baltimore. Most young professionals want to leave because they don't want to have to drive. They don't want to have to park. They would like to go to a park and ride and go downtown, enjoy the Inner Harbor, go out to security, and highlight the pretty things in our communities. I was impacted by the highway to nowhere. And West Baltimore, for us getting a parking lot to address the parking problem of the Mark Station, that's making progress. We haven't gotten everything, but at least we're at the table and continue to be at the table. And that's what I would like to see for all of these communities. Because I went to Denver, and I talked to the people on High Street or in the black community, and they said how they went about it. And they say it had to come to a win-win. We're not going to get everything, but we got to think about
right.
our future.
Joyce, we're almost out of time, but let me ask you to hold on. We get our producer to get your telephone number so we can talk to you more about this as we develop this conversation in all our communities. Just try to get a quick thought from Don from Rodnell Heights.
Talk to you more about this.
Don, we have only about a minute left, so go ahead.
Right. Good afternoon. My name is Don. How's everyone doing?
Good, Don. We don't have much time, so.
Good. The issue here, it was, as it relates to this red line, is this: east and west. We will not get a red line if they continue to be involved in environmental injustice violations. The city knows that they are planning this with a bias against the southwest. The state knows it, and the governor knows it. There will not be a red line because, again, this is going to be a matter that really is going to end up in court. There's no way that the governor is going to allow this rail line to be on the surface through all the low-income community in southwest Baltimore and most of the money to be spent downtown and east Baltimore, 80% of the tunnel to be in downtown and East Baltimore.
Okay, we're done. I have to only cut off because we only have like a minute left. And that's how real is the argument that most of the money is going to the east side, not the west side, and that's where all the above ground is.
Well, first of all, I don't think it's true. I mean, if you look at the number of miles of tunnel, especially in residential areas, you have more on the west side than the east side because we're underneath Cook's Lane. Number one, number two. The very reason that we're struggling with this question of Evanston Avenue and Boston Street is because in order to meet the very test that Don talks about in terms of the environmental justice requirements, we would have to be able to afford to do both Evanston Avenue and Boston Street. And that's another $700 million that we just don't have.
Gentlemen, this is not the way I wanted to end this show. I wanted to try to kind of wrap things up a little bit more than we did. I do apologize, but we will come back to this, and I appreciate you all taking your time. We'll come back here for another hour or more just to, we have to to look, see where we're going. This is really critical to the future of this entire community, Baltimore County and Baltimore City. I want to thank Jamie Kendrick always for being willing to come in and speak to the communities, and Warren Smith and Daryl Jerkowitz for joining us from their neighborhoods and being here as part of this discussion. And your involvement in our civic life is really important to both of you. Thank you very much
for that.
Thank
you, Mark.
And Dan Pontius, always a pleasure to have you here. And next time we'll have a show and you want to have a meeting, you can get here and
That's
have
right,
a great
I'll be day. Right from
the
beginning
next it's good to have you here. Thank you so much. We are going to take a short break. I want to remind you that the Maryland Film Festival runs from May 7th through 10th. It's the region premier film event, over 130 films of all types from all over the world with filmmakers and other surprises, a film for everyone. For all details and to purchase tickets, to guarantee you can get to the movies you want, go to mdfilmfest.com. Stay with us. We will be right back, and we are going to have another very interesting conversation and debate on population. Are there too many people? What do we do in America and the world about that? Stay with us. We'll be back in just a minute.